Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney-at-law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney-at-law from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and we're expecting today Greg Glazer, a constitutional lawyer from California, to come on the show, and we'll just be waiting for him today. I'm going to start off with a little quote from Edward Abbey. It says, "A patriot must always be ready to defend his country against the government." I don't know how that's going to play into our talk today, our discussion, but I thought it sounded pretty good. So I'm sure that Alan will have something to teach us about that little quote. In the meantime, you can become part of this educational movement simply by telling your friends to listen into the show. Send them an email with a link. Tweet it on Twitter. Post a share using your share button on Facebook, Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace, or any other social network. You can copy the embed code for the show and put it on your website or blog so people can listen directly to any of the podcasts or archives of these shows. Become a favorite for the show, favorite the show, and become a regular listener. Push the reminder button, and you will get updates for whatever shows we have going on, whether they're Monday night with Grant Bentley talking about facial analysis, or Wednesday mornings with Dr. Adil talking about cardiology health. We have this show on Thursday at noon, and following this show at 1 p.m., Dr. Christina Chambreau talks about pet health. So today we're going to be talking about constitutional rights, and we're going to focus on emergency powers and the Constitution. We're going to talk about an overview of how the Constitution explicitly addresses these emergency powers, for instance, the right of habeas corpus. So, Alan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Debbie. Good to be here again with you. We missed you last week. Glad to have you back. And I see attorney Greg Glazer is on the line with us now as well.
Hey, guys.
Bring him in. How you doing this morning, Greg?
Oh, doing well. Thank you very much.
And we also have the chat. The chat is open for anyone who has tuned in. We have a guest already listening. So come on, put your comments in, put your questions in, and we will address them directly on the air.
You know, Greg, I actually had a conversation just this morning with an activist up in Vermont. They're trying to get rid of the activists or not, but pro-vaccine folks up there are trying to get rid of the philosophical exemption. And the woman on phone was saying to me that she had been in touch with the ACLU, and they have explained to her that there's no constitutional issue here, and this just really rubs some people the wrong way. You know, I heard a lot, especially during the pandemic, but even before and after, where people say they have or feel they should have, at the very least, a constitutional right to decide what does or doesn't go into their body. And we know historically with vaccines, at least the way the courts have ruled, that's not always the case. And if that factors into what you prepared to talk with us about today, would love to hear your comments about that. Where do our constitutional rights end as it concerns vaccines or other healthcare treatment and so forth. So, Greg, with no further ado, welcome aboard and take it away.
All right. Thanks so much. Yeah, the United States Constitution very seldomly discusses emergency powers, interestingly. Emergency powers are traditionally given to the states, and it's your state constitution which grants your governor the emergency power in your state. And then even more so, local health authorities generally have emergency health powers. And that is a and that comes from the tradition of governance from all the way back to the days of Roman rule. And so in the United States Constitution, you have the provision that says that habeas corpus, which is a right to petition for a for release of a prisoner, can be suspended during times of rebellion. And that's just one of the rare examples where the U.S. Constitution has something about emergency powers. And, you know, again, it's because it's the states that have the emergency power. So in your state constitution, it'll say that your governor has the emergency authority, and then your state will enact an emergency, will have a government code or an emergency services code, which will cover the extent of the authority given to the state in an emergency. And it's going to be extensive. Like, Alan, have you taken a look at the North Carolina statute for this?
I have in recent months looked at that, and that's what actually led here in North Carolina to my meeting with, or part of what led to me meeting with state health director and my state senator a few months ago. We were originally meeting to say we wanted to have the authority to refuse vaccines in an emergency, because it looked to me like the way it's set up in North Carolina, and as you point out, it's different in every state, but they had a separate chapter for public health and distinct from that chapter on emergency, how to deal with emergencies, and it looked to me like the law was at best unclear about specifically the right to any kind of exemptions to vaccines in an emergency for emergency vaccines. Curiously, the state policy at that time was they say that the current exemptions, here we have just the medical and religious, they say as a matter of policy that does apply during emergencies. In fact, they're not concerned about people trying to avoid vaccines in an emergency. They're concerned about the panic of people trying to get the vaccines in an emergency, which is sort of funny because most of us can think back and remember seeing on the news the long lines of people down for blocks waiting for their swine flu vaccines.
Right, and now they're advertising it at Walgreens.
Right. So the hysteria was very effective, the fear campaign, very effective in getting people to line up for the vaccines. But the truth is that, as I read it in North Carolina, the law was unclear. So we have a pending bill now, 508, that would just make very minor modifications in the current vaccine religious exemption laws to clarify that they also apply during an emergency.
Wait a second. The law is unclear. Alan, you're an attorney. You're not allowed to say that.
One of the curious things about the practice of law, Greg, that comes up for me over and over with clients is that I'm constantly or repeatedly explaining that sometimes the law isn't clear on a particular point. And what I find in vaccine exemption and waiver arena, it is often there are often areas lacking clarity.
I'm always pulling up. I really like to research and read law review articles and old cases, and read about history. And I'm constantly pulling up citations, quotes from very famous lawyers, including Supreme Court justices, where they are openly saying, the law is unclear, it's untested in this area. We're just kind of some is almost being as blatant as we're making it up as it goes. Like, here's a quote from Justice Charles Evan Hughes. Quote, "We are under a constitution, but the constitution is what judges say it is."
Right. Well, the constitution necessarily is general to, I would assert anyway, general to vague on many points, just because there's a hypothetically infinite number of specific issues that could arise. I mean, the constitution doesn't say anything about vaccines, for example, and yet people claim we have a constitutional right to this, that, or the other regarding vaccines. Well, how do we know that? And so, you know, what I think a lot of people don't understand.
One way we know is the Constitution has a guarantee clause which says we are guaranteed a Republican form of government, which means that you have basic individual liberties. Now, compare the classic French system of the Napoleonic Code, where everything was prohibited unless Napoleon said it was legal. So a republic is the opposite of that. Everything is legal unless it is prohibited. And we also incorporate the classic common law. So all these court opinions which say whether something is illegal also applies de facto in American courts. So like, for example, assault and battery, whether it was codified or not by any particular state statute, it was still illegal to do an assault and battery. So that helps clarify a little bit, I think.
Yeah, but what we have in civilization is complex and such as it is in our world today is where we have things are continually shifting and changing, if we're lucky, evolving in a positive direction. But nonetheless, you know, there are new situations emerge all the time, and in particular, for example, in recent years, new technologies. And these raise new legal questions and new questions that have never been raised before. As new situations come up, well, what are the boundaries now legally for this, that, or the other? And so the Constitution is something that is constantly being interpreted and reinterpreted over the years. And, of course, this happened
with expanding federal power lately. You know, like in the emergency case, which is our topic for today, the Constitution, you know, as I said, it has very rarely does it even bring up the emergency context. Habeas corpus is the example. And so what courts have done is they've tried to interpret it into it. So, like, there's a provision in the Constitution which says that the president must take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And so the president's law enforcement powers have grown in proportion to this provision and in terms of courts interpreting it over time. And, you know, and sometimes it is you know, it looks like it's going to be a positive thing at the outset, and it can be used positively, but then it's later run roughshod over. So, like, one dramatic example would be in 1962, when President John F. Kennedy, he ordered U.S. Marshals and Army troops to quell riots, protesting a court order that required the University of Mississippi to integrate its student body by admitting a black student, James Meredith. And you know, that would be an example where, you know, you have federal power coming in to promote a legitimate concern, which is to quell a riot, you know, a race riot. And then, but it grows into something that becomes much larger and then can be used to quell dissent, you know, even political dissent in the future, like, you know, quashing free speech and stuff like that.
Do we have any examples that you're aware of in recent times? Feel like there's been an overstep or an overreach or a questionable use?
Sure. How about November 2001? Right after September 11th, George Bush authorizes the use of military tribunals for trying foreigners accused of terrorist acts. You know, and he says that the emergency powers under the Commander-in-Chief Clause give him the latitude to put these measures in place. But there is no emergency powers that he's interpreting it. He's interpreting the law to say. So he took that one example of faithfully executing the laws to allow him to try foreigners accused of terrorist acts without, you know, in a military tribunal. And so just by characterizing the matter, he was able to extend his own authority. You know, or another example would be the executive order. It's where. You know, executive order is where the president issues an order to the departments, his cabinet, where now this power is defined nowhere in the Constitution, but it's construed as a presidential directive that becomes law without congressional approval. So it's ways for the government to encroach upon traditional state power. Not that states have a tradition of being better enforcers of law. One example in history would be in 1892, the cholera outbreak in New York. This was where, you know, cholera, it's this, it's like a bacterial infection which is transmitted through could be transmitted through fecal matter, just poor hygiene, but it's not transmitted as an airborne, like through coughing.
Right.
And but the public health authorities didn't know this at the time, and so they issued all sorts of lofty quarantine orders at the time, and then it was an interesting example of how the issue became entwined with race, where the press and the government were blaming, even the Surgeon General at the time, were blaming immigrants for being this great cause of this problem. And so the cholera outbreak, once it was concluded, I think it was the next year, many commentators at the time were calling for more federal authority. They thought that New York State didn't adequately, you know, address their needs. And so it just became this this way to take a look at history and say, oh, well, if only we had the federal government to do it better. It's kind of like how law goes in cycles, where you know, it's like, oh, the Republicans got it wrong. Let's enact the Democrats. You know, well, let's enact the Republicans. And elect, rather. And this cycle allows the appearance that that law and order is being maintained. And in a sense it is, but it's just fluctuating. It's not like a system of clear-cut rights and responsibilities. It just fluctuates over time.
Really a checks and balances, so to speak, then, or...?
Yeah,
or,
well, I mean,
you might not really,
analyze,
or sort of reining it in if it gets out of hand.
Yeah.
Well, you said cycles. You could also think of it in terms of like a pendulum, the way things swing from one side to the other, and we don't really maintain a balance in the middle. There's no enough compromise or understanding about the extremes. And so you say, so this went wrong, so let's fix it. And you fix it by swinging the whole other way. And I don't know whether that's something that you see happening in terms of these, you called it cycles.
Yeah. And I borrowed that actually from a legal commentator, Bruce Ackerman, who wrote in the Yale Law Journal, wrote an article called The Emergency Constitution. And he goes into more detail on these cycles. And actually, it's very critical. It's kind of comical, Alan. I think you'd appreciate it. And he's talking about the common law fog. It allows judges to, you know, regale themselves with these commentaries on emergency powers, you know, cautioning this and cautioning that, and saying this is unconstitutional. 20 years go by, and then they just get to confuse their logic with dicta and occasional restrictive rulings, and then it just reboots. It just starts all over again when the next crisis comes. You know, so it's like they take the emergency powers whenever the crisis hits, and then they take the next 20 years to criticize themselves. But it's just a cycle.
So maybe you can explain to me, the emergency powers is something that the public, the people, the civilians of the country allow the government to take upon themselves, these vast powers to do really major changes that are not within the Constitution of typically on a day-to-day basis, and then once they have the powers, they just hold on to them and keep them to expand more and more powers. Maybe you can explain to me a little bit more how that works.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's a strong deference to public health authorities in times of emergency, and this comes from the traditional power of quarantine, which dates all the way back the word itself, quarantine, means 40, and it comes from the old time when they could quarantine a ship and its cargo and passengers for 40 days. But you can really trace the examples of epidemics back to the BC days. Sanitation laws can be found in the Book of Leviticus. The Romans had a system for sanitary engineering and waterworks, and so it really started with sanitation laws. And then this was adopted into English law, which recognized the right of the state to quarantine and limit the movement of anything suspected of carrying any type of plague. And as one legal commentator noted, Blackstone, Alan and I read Blackstone in law school, he observed that disobeying quarantine orders merited severe punishments, which included death. So it was and the reason why the penalties were so strong and the presumption of state authority was so pronounced was because of great fear of pandemic. You know, back in times when sanitation was so difficult to achieve, it was, the case that you had much greater outbreaks when outbreaks did occur. And so there was, together with this factual climate, you had the legal climate of granting great deference to the states. And that showed up in our Supreme Court authority. And, you know, traditionally it came up through commerce and ships, where the authority to quarantine ships was highlighted in Supreme Court decisions as early as 1824 with Gibbons v. Ogden and lots of lower court decisions where they were just talking about how, you know, when ships come in, it's within the authority of the port to stop the ship, inspect it, give it a certificate of a clean bill of health, and if it doesn't pass authority, then it just gets shipped right on back to where it came from.
It makes complete sense. I mean, even today, the fact that transportation, a lot of things are very mobile through the airlines, just things that cling on to the cargo, or when people bring on plants or molds or bacteria or virus, they pick something up and they get sick and they get on the plane, they go home, and it travels very, very quickly, quicker than ever in history. And so this concept of fear is really embedded into our psyche. And so when we have this fear, the people or the persons in authority can utilize that fear to do whatever they like, because we feel we're out of control. We don't have the power to stop any types of contagious epidemics or the spread of other kinds of things coming in.
I think you just really hit the nail on the head there with that analysis. That is the essence of the issue that transcends legal environments. I could go on and talk for hours about the history of the American Constitution, examples from going all the way back to Roman rule, but I don't think I'm going to be able to get deeper than what you just said about the fear of it. You know, you can impose any legal structure on a society, but when you get down to the basics of what is being thrust upon the society, it's where you have many individuals who are in a state of fear, and they are rejecting something that comes from outside of themselves. And they have a legal structure which will give them some words to try to apply a rationale for what they have already pre-decided to do, which is take that foreign object and get it as far away from themselves as possible.
So the end result of all of this that comes into play when we hear in the news constantly about things that are coming into our environment, are coming into our space, are coming into our homes, our neighborhoods, whether it be an outbreak of whooping cough or MRSA or infectious disease, whatever it might be, the results of the authority end up to be a restriction of our movement. You know, you have to have these passports or documents to show certain things about yourself, and then they gather more information about you. It's a restriction of your freedoms, not only to movement, but to what were you saying, to utilize what constitutional laws that you supposedly have in place. You can be held without really knowledge of why you're being held. Just different things. You could be quarantined. What are the other things? Your water, you know, the water that you use. I mean, all sorts of things that are in today's world can cause the not only your the restriction of your movement or your communication, that you're being wiretapped, all sorts of things that are going on because the powers above you are taking authority. How can we get our authority back? How can we get our freedom back?
Well, I think there's a fundamental point here we need to bring out, because the role of government, the reason that we there's potentially legitimate need for, I would assert, for government to have some authority in this arena, but the underlying idea here, and maybe it's one that bears a little bit of exploration, is the idea that we have government to protect us from ourselves. I mean, the whole reason that we would have health agencies setting up rules about who can do what when under what condition and who has authority to suspend the rules or change the rules in an emergency and who can go how far and so forth, all of this seems to me to be a very complicated network of rules and procedures ultimately designed to have government protect us from ourselves. Where is the point that we genuinely are not able to make decisions for ourselves in a way that are in our and our community's best interests? I mean, Greg, do you see this as a, first of all, I guess traditionally and presently as an aspect of what's going on, if maybe worded simplistically, government protecting us from ourselves, and where does that become abused or misused?
It becomes abused and misused when the government lacks the tools to actually protect the public. I mean, when you come to be an independent researcher, you learn to expect hypocrisy. You know, you don't just say, oh, look, there's a hypocrite. No, it's the standard. And when I look at epidemics, which have really ravaged the United States throughout history, I see so many examples where courts have upheld the power of local authorities to implement what in hindsight were terrible public health measures, including quarantines and that targeted specific race groups and classes. Like one example would be in San Francisco, Yickwo v. Hopkins, where they took many Chinese immigrants and just put them all in camps. And these camps were derogable. They had just poor living conditions. And what did it do? Of course, there were, it increased the incidence of disease that were originally sought to be deterred in the very first place. And so when I look at in the big picture at the federal government today, and I think of an emergency situation, my fear is that the federal government can't control its own pollution. You know, it has all these nuclear installations and weapons stockpiles. And, take a look at the Fukushima example, you know, the earthquake that ravaged Japan, and you had one nuclear plant that leaked, and that just devastated the country, and it still is. And, America, even more so with all of the installations here. And so, you know, I read this emergency literature, and they are talking about, you know, going into private lands and, you know, forcing medical examinations and forcing medical treatment upon these individuals. And I'm just imagining some naturopathic person who is on their own private land and they're trying not to get hunted down by their own species, you know. And meanwhile, you know, there's nuclear leaks and stuff, but the federal government is concerned with this naturopath. You know, it's just, it doesn't, it's one more example of hypocrisy where, you talk about, in the healthcare industry, you talk about the triad, you know, where you focus on the most important threat first. Well, it seems like they got it backwards.
So can you tell us, what are these that read the emergency literature you mentioned? Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how the habeas corpus is suspended?
Yeah, of course. Like for example, if you want to look in California, go to Government Code 8570, and it'll talk about what the governor can do in accordance with the state emergency plan. And, you know, a lot of it's basic, you know, if you plan for and procures medical supplies and equipment and then takes all appropriate steps to ensure, you know, the proper delivery and mobilization of emergency organizations and so forth. And then when you look at we had a whole show, remember, on the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, where I covered in pretty good detail the things that the Georgetown University wants to give the states for power, and it's just full-on taking over control of the details of an individual's life and the infrastructure of society, where they can actually, you know, again, go onto your private property and then take you, test you medically, and then if you are determined to have a disease or in any way resist their treatments, then they can quarantine you, treat, decontaminate, vaccinate, and so forth. And if you resist, you know, if you exercise an exemption, then according to the Congressional Research Service, they can put you into a quarantine or isolation. But once you're in quarantine or isolation, you're like a prisoner. What is the guarantee that your exemptions will continue to be respected? And when I looked at the prisoner cases throughout history, I found that the prisoners' rights are not respected at all. You know, you end up resisting vaccines, and what do they give you? They give you, you know, prison, and do they give you organic food, you know, natural remedies? No, you're just, like, you know, being treated like cattle. And even in the international sphere, you know, I was combing over international regulations regarding, like, treaties and executive agreements that cover providing for the basic necessities of human life, which is, like, sort of an offshoot of the Geneva Conventions. What is the terminology? I forget the exact terminology, but it's the premise that when you have a prisoner, you have to provide for their basic necessities. And nothing in this, in these provisions, international provisions, I could find related to the idea that what if a prisoner wants organic food, or what if they want only natural remedies? It's this delusion of one size fits all, this delusion of the conventional response is the standard and appropriate response to the human condition. That's this great fallacy that is just that just permeates throughout throughout these laws.
So what you're saying is that there's a sequence of events that takes place when a pandemic or something is declared, and now the regular powers that be that we, you know, expect in our everyday life has changed, and there's a new kind of law over the country where now your space can be invaded, your property can be invaded, you can be tested and put into a new facility that's not your own space, that you can make your own personal private decisions any longer, and to the extent where you actually lose your rights. And you can't, you don't have any method to make your own personal choices for whether it is hygiene or healthcare or whatever it might be. And this really goes to an extreme simply by making a declaration. So one of the things that the in the chat, someone has asked us whether Congress can override an executive order.
Yes. Yeah, and the only exception would be if you have a situation where it's the exclusive domain of the executive. So that might be a treaty or an executive agreement where the president in a matter of international affairs where the president is given the exclusive authority over negotiations with foreign states. And so the president can go and make an executive there's actually a difference between an executive order and an executive agreement, where he can go out and make an agreement with another foreign national. Now, Congress has to approve treaties, but not executive agreements. But, yeah, if Congress overrules an executive order, the president's duty to faithfully execute the laws of the nation trumps the executive order.
So therefore, if we as individuals petition our local representatives, our state representatives in the Senate and the House, and we say, this is the way we want to run our local community. We don't want to have fluoride in the water. We don't want to have a specific vaccination for our children to go to school. These kinds of things, if we really make a loud noise to our governing body, that they can then go to the Congress and en masse and change or say, no, we don't want what the president has to tell us to do?
The president has to report to Congress, and the provisions of each individual act under which the president claims emergency authority. So, like in our question, it's, you know, can the president declare a pandemic and do things without congressional approval? Well, yeah, but it depends on which statute under which he's claiming the authority. Like, let's say he's commandeering the channels of transportation of goods. Then that's going to invoke, I think, under a national disaster. So that might invoke the Stafford Act of 1974. And then so we look in the Stafford Act and see, okay, well, what are the provisions for how often the president has to report to Congress and get congressional approval? And remember, Congress is approving his budget already, so there's already this sort of open communication. And, you know, there's examples in history where the president didn't report in time with God. Like, I think Jimmy Carter got hit with that once. But, there's systems in place to just kind of tacitly approve these things.
How fast do the people have to act? I mean, the higher authorities, the executive branch and everything, and the legislative branch, they can really potentially act very quickly. The president sits down one day and says, you know, I have all of these types of facts here in front of my desk that my departments have given me, and I think that I need to make a really fast decision without really the whole nation knowing all of these details. So where do we come in to the decision-making process? Can you hear me? Yeah, okay.
I think it's untested. You know, even with the swine flu of 2009, there was no declaration from, you know, there was no Stafford Act declaration. So, let me take a look at that question. I'll see if I can find a better answer for the next show, because
Well, it's an interesting point, because Obama did declare a national swine flu emergency, and that did, in my understanding, set up conditions that allowed things to happen that could not otherwise have happened in terms of how the whole, especially with vaccines, how all that played out. But it's an important question, because the system of law, the available rights, who can do what or not do what, as you know, of course, Greg, as well or better than myself, it can shift radically in the context of a declared emergency. And so I think what I hear, at least part of what Debbie's question goes to, is the problem that sometimes our elected officials can make decisions and act fairly quickly, and our ability as constituents to address something of that nature, especially in an emergency, with any sort of effectiveness and promptness, is probably pretty limited. I mean, in theory, that's the reason we elect officials in the first place, so they can handle those things, and we don't have to go through, a democratic procedure of getting the whole nation to consider every important decision and weigh in on it. You know, we have the elected officials and appointed agency officials and so forth to handle all those things for us. Of course, the problem then that we address over and over throughout the years at this point in this show is how an exploration of what that authority is and how and when is it being misused or abused. And it raised a question, as you, if I'm not veering us too far off backwards or off the subject here, but as you're talking about, you've seen all these problems in the way things have played out historically, bad judgments and so forth. I was just curious, Greg, when you're looking at the history of all this, how much of the problems that you see in terms of the way things were managed and mismanaged is a result of just people doing the best they could at the time and out of ignorance or lack of sufficient information, they make a call, it turns out to be the wrong call, versus somebody in a more calculated way manipulating and abusing power to achieve a contrary end or purpose? Because my impression would be, and I may be absolutely wrong on this, my impression is that the organized misuse, deliberate misuse of power is something that I think has been increasing in recent decades in its scope and depth and the extent to which it's just even come out more and more in the open, almost like a we don't care if you know what we're doing, we can do it anyway sort of mentality and attitude. Do you see this as something that's gone on through history or has increased over recent years?
Yeah. I think that it's common for ideologues and zealots to find themselves in positions of power. And there are so-called gatekeepers. They're like prison wardens almost who keep these powers in check. And it only takes one prison warden to open the doors to a prison and just let all these people out of jail to see havoc wreaked on society. And it's not like there's a great conspiracy among all of those inmates to go wreak havoc on society, but rather you just know the predictable response. And so I feel that when it comes to the healthcare landscape, you have many ideologues and very passionate people who really want to go out and help society through their programs. Without realizing that the programs are part of greater institutions of control and that these programs end up wreaking a lot of havoc. And oversimplification, because you can't take it separate from the infrastructure. It's like, you'll have a program that may accomplish a lot of law and order, but at the same time, the solutions themselves, if carried out in a true draconian fashion, cause great injustice. And also because they're draconian, prevent the building of alternate methods for a sustainable community. And so history doesn't even get to analyze the possibilities of where the community could have protected itself. All we see are the examples where the community didn't protect itself and the public authorities exercise power. And then we get to criticize it or praise it.
That's a good point. I'm going to take a real quick moment here. There's a question about, can the president declare a pandemic and do things without congressional approval, and can he force us to be vaccinated? And Greg, I want to take the second part of that one, but put the first one back to you to see what your understanding and insights are on that. But as to vaccination, and by all means, Greg, feel free to clarify or correct or what have you on my understanding here, but I believe that for most of us, for state residents, that there's probably not much of any situation where the federal government can directly mandate vaccines for state residents. I think that really has to come from the state level, although if we had a federal mandate, it wouldn't be the first time that arguably the federal government has overstepped its authority, but I think when Obama declared a national swine flu emergency, I don't think that set up a situation where the federal government could mandate that any state residents be vaccinated. But I do think it set up an atmosphere where states may have been more likely to declare their own emergencies, and that certainly sets up the possibility of mandatory vaccines. With that particular so-called pandemic, we saw that in New York, where the state temporarily mandated swine flu vaccines for healthcare workers, which may have been a test as much as anything else, really, to see how people would respond to it. But just my personal opinion there. But what about that? The president declares a pandemic, and what can the president do at that point, if anything? And can the president do anything without congressional approval? Surely there would be some authority, I would think, on the part of a president to act unilaterally in an emergency just for efficiency's sake.
Mm-hmm.
You have any insights on that?
You know, just taking a look here at, you know, what the president's example of the declaration for the H1N1 flu pandemic. And, you know, that's one I'd like to research a little bit more. I know that there's a Congressional Research Service paper on that. And as to the question of whether we could be forcefully vaccinated following a pandemic, you know, I'd invite reading of my memorandum on that point. The short answer is that no, if you're peacefully natural, it doesn't matter whether they call it emergency, a pandemic, or a smorgasbord. You have a right to be peacefully natural, and they can't stick a needle in you. Now, with that said, the government does seem to recognize three exceptions to that. If you are an immediate threat to another person, like, for example, you can be proven to have a contagious disease and you're entering the public square or coughing on someone, then it's like a exercise of self-defense to exercise controls over you, which may include forced medical treatment or quarantine. And another example would be if you're already in prison for a crime other than just refusing vaccination, then you're just subjected to the parens patriae rule, which is, you know, the state can pretty much take care of all of your needs, you know, food, medicine, and then, you know, at that point you're in the system, so you're out of luck. And, you know, Kathleen Swendeman wrote an article on this. I found a Congressional Research Service paper on that, and she acknowledges that they can't forcefully vaccinate anyone, even during an emergency. The most they can do is put you in quarantine or into isolation. So, you know, that's one aspect of it. But then I find, you know, in reading the Model State Health Emergency Powers Act, that forced medical treatment may be subjected to different rules. So I'm taking a look at that right now, and I'm planning on drafting a research paper, as Alan and I have talked about. But I think, you know, ultimately we're just going to find that different camps are going to give you different answers to that question as to whether or not you can be forcefully vaccinated. You know, if you look at the old days, pretty much do, you know, what they wanted to you once you're in the system. And that's kind of what I'm finding, is that if you can stay out of the system, then you have a better chance of not being forcefully vaccinated. Because once you get processed by the system, then you're subject to detention right away. You know, you could be quarantined or put into a prison. And then this detention can only last so long. Sometimes it's indefinite detention if you're an alien. But it is you know, it's detention for a specific amount of time before you get a tribunal, which would be a military tribunal in the case of a pandemic. And there they're just going to use their own experts. And the two different legal commentators who I found that offer different takes on this, one is Mariner, who I liked her position better, and the other was Galva. And so it really comes up in the example of the suspension of habeas corpus, which is a great segue, because that's one of our main topics for today. So, you know, the Constitution says that this great writ can be suspended in cases of rebellion or invasion. And at the time of the Constitution's enactment, it was something that was put in at the very end when I don't even think it was debated. One of the precedents for it was President Grant suspended habeas corpus while suppressing the Ku Klux Klan in the post-war South. And so we have examples as well in the medical context for when it can be invoked and how what the standard is for invoking it. So essentially, let's take a hypothetical. There's just been an infectious disease outbreak, and you are on your private property, and the public health officials come to you. They come right up to your door, your gate, and they say that, there's a public health emergency. We're going through the neighborhood and testing every person to make sure that they don't have this virus. Do you consent to a test? Well, if you consent to a test, then you have you are waiving your constitutional right to be free from forced testing because it's consent. But if you don't consent, then according to the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, you can be forcefully tested. But that's not the rule in many states because many states have not enacted that provision. But what they have done is they have very broad language, which gives the public health authorities the authority over things like testing. So it's undecided, whether they can forcefully test or not. And so what we do is we look at individual cases in the last century which have dealt with forceful testing. And what they have found is that great deference is given to courts. Courts give great deference to the public health authorities in their rulings for infringements against individual liberty. So what they do is if you reject testing, then according to one commentator, he says that all courts need is a quote, reasonable belief for whether you have the disease. And when they've looked at cases which have analyzed reasonable belief, they'll look at your obviously, if there's already a diagnosis that you have something, like if you went to a doctor and you showed symptoms of the virus, even though they didn't test for the virus, that would be a reasonable belief that you have the virus, in which case they can go ahead and detain you. So, like an example would be in the case of In re Martin, 1948, and the issue was these people were arrested for vagrancy. And then they were detained by the police on the grounds that they had a venereal disease. And so the question was whether or not a reasonable ground existed to support the belief that they had this disease. And so they could look at the person's lifestyle and say, oh, well, here you have a vagrant. They're more likely to have a venereal disease, any outward symptoms that you have. So once they have a reasonable basis for that, they can take the next steps. And so it goes back to the original point that I'm making that, once you get processed by the system, you're at risk for losing your rights. And the farther along you are in the system, if you've been charged with something, the less rights you are likely to have. Now, so that was an example from one commentator, Galva. Now, another commentator, Mariner, says that, now she looked at mental institution cases and said that there's actually a greater standard that courts have to meet. So they couldn't just look at you and say, oh, well, we're going to look at this guy's lifestyle and see if he's, a danger to others. What she says is that courts, that they have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the person is ill and they represent a danger to other people. And so when the question is formed in that way, there's a much higher threshold, and so your rights have greater protection. And so, I can cite cases from both camps, and, there's really no clear answer how that would be decided on the ground in our hypothetical.
Do you think a threshold might vary according to the severity or perceived severity of the emergency?
Yes.
The swine flu was hyped a lot, but ultimately turned out to be a very, very mild disease. But if we had a similar kind of pandemic where people were dropping like flies all over the world, we'd certainly have people for practical reasons, if nothing else, people behaving, I think, in a much different way.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. You know, and when we look at history, it goes back to Debbie's point earlier that, you know, the greater the fear, the greater the
Okay, we've got about 3 minutes left. I don't know whether anybody can hear me because the sound has been kind of fading in and out today. Why don't you just say a last statement, Greg, and perhaps we want to continue with the same line of discussion in the next time you get on with us?
Yeah, that sounds nice. Yeah, I think this is, you know, a really extensive topic, and you know, there's so many historical examples that would be useful to courts and are also just interesting as we learn about law and also about human behavior.
Okay, well, this has been really fascinating. I feel as if listening to all of this, depending upon who is in power, who's making decisions, what judge you have before you, whether you're dealing with states' rights or federal rights, what kind of atmosphere of fear we have going on or atmosphere of security we feel is going to depend upon how we maintain or lose our rights. There's so many variables. So we have somebody coming on the line. I don't know who it is. Who else has come on? Let me just check this. Hello, is there a caller coming in today?
It's Christina Chambreau.
Okay, well, we're going to be on in about 3 minutes you.
I always come in to listen at the end.
Wonderful. And so I do want to make an announcement for those who are listening today to our show that Christina will be with us at 1 o'clock for homeopathy and pet health, and we're going to be talking about diet and nutrition. It might be interesting for those who have been concerned about their constitutional rights. So I want to thank Greg again so much for coming on and discussing his field of expertise with us, and for Alan, who has always been very faithful in keeping the shows running even when I'm not available. And for those folks who are regular listeners, please do continue to share with your friends and your colleagues, whether you're in just a public citizen or you're in the area of law. Also, we want to tell you about Alan's e-guide, and there's a link on Blog Talk Radio there and also on Homeopathy World Community. And just tell us how we can contact you, Greg, and then we'll move on to the next show.
Sure. You can check out my website, civilactionnetwork.org. I also wanted to leave you guys with a kind of a funny quote from Voltaire. He says, "The art of medicine consists of amusing the patient while nature cures the disease."
And, very good.
I thought that was funny, and it really made me think. So I thought, well, perhaps the art of law consists of amusing the citizen while political regimes run their course.
Write that down and send it to us. It sounds good. I'm going to end the show, and we'll see you in a minute.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.